Right, accordingly, I've got, I think, 1.5 minutes to give this talk, so.
No less.
Get less.
negative time.
Right, get ready. Up front, I'd like to particularly acknowledge, well, in particular, two of my co-authors, Steve Jeffries, who's the lead breeder or CEO, I think, these days at AGT. Breeding company in Australia, and Lindsay O'Brien at University of Sydney, who also works for Longreach Syngenta, and Tom Giles from GRDC. And some of this talk is based on talks that Steve's given. Some of this talk is based on talks that Steve's given in the past, and usually to the wheat breeders in Australia, and he's provided a lot of the notes behind the history of this. So wheat's the major field crop in Australia. The farms are extensive. There are some farmers in places like Western Australia leasing up to 20,000 hectares as small companies and running those. The yields are sort of 1.5 to 3 tonnes per hectare, and we produce about 20 million tonnes in a good year, and you can see here how variable our years can be. Usually if a very low year means that Western Australia had a disastrous rainfall during the winter. I thought I'd just give a bit of a history and then some thoughts about future work. So it's been over 100 years of wheat breeding in Australia, with Farah being the first official wheat breeder, employed in 1898 by the Government of New South Wales, and he worked on these varieties and delivered an earlier maturing rust-tolerant line federation. And through the 1930s, South Australia particularly got involved. Roseworthy Ag College was established before 1900 as well, but they had a stronger focus on grain quality. And then sort of through the 40s and 50s, these state and university breeding programs were established, and you can see them listed there. They occur across the whole wheat belt. That's about 5,000 kilometres across Australia and about 2,000 kilometres north to south, to give you some idea of the scale. But the fundamental changes that allowed privatisation of breeding were started in 1987 when the Plant Breeders' Rights Act was enacted, and then it was amended following the UPOV convention to allow you to charge royalties on harvested product. And that was absolutely key. And in 1998, the grower-led introduction of the endpoint royalty system. And this was, I mean, some key points about how endpoint royalties were established were that, I mean, obviously the breeders were allowed to capture the return at any point during the use of a variety, so they could decide where they wanted to collect it. Royalties paid on the production from the variety, not on the purchase of seed. And in Australia in particular, it was facilitated by the fact that we already had a research levy collection system. So delivered seed had a research levy that went to GRDC, which varies from sort of 1% to 2%. But because that system was already in place and collection of an endpoint royalty was rather easy to deploy, it just meant that you had to identify the variety and the funds had to go to the breeding company. The risk is shared because you're on the endpoint. So in Australia, if you don't get much seed that year, the breeding company doesn't get much money, which can be a bit tough if you're a breeding company and you have a bad year. So when there's only 10 million tonnes instead of 20 million tonnes, there's obviously a lot less return. But it still took another 4 or 5 years from around about 2000 for this model to take over. But all varieties since 2001 have had EPR, and the highest price that's charged these days is about $4.25 for a variety per tonne harvested. I think the average is around $2.50 to $3 now. And 81% of the current crop is EPR varieties, and there's still a few that were pre-2001. Oops. So what's it look like now in the 21st century? Well, in 1998, we were 98% public breeding. I think there was only one little breeding company in WA, and the total investment was $18 million per year. Now, that's not counting GRDC's research investment. In 2013, it's 100% private, and it's twice as much money invested, and our inflation hasn't been that much in 15 years. There are six major companies, and you can see that all six of those major companies have major multinationals as partners. And the current market share, there's still 40% market share is owned by public agency-owned varieties that were registered before all this corporate model was fully in place. So they were registered sort of between the 1998 and about 2005 or so. So they're still occupying that, but 60% of, 80% of the varieties are EPR covered, and 60% of the total varieties are actually supplied by these private companies from their breeding programs. So I talked to a few of the companies, and particularly AGT, but their major challenges were this exposure to the seasonal conditions. They've got to do a lot of risk management for something like wheat. You can tell that with the conditions varying so much in performance of the whole nation, in a year where the rainfall outlook isn't so good, we're in an El Nino or something like that, the tendency is that there might be less seed planted, but at least if it does get planted and it does yield, there will be a return. So there's still a lot of farmer-supplied seed. The farmers are still reusing their own material, but the royalties are being paid at the end. But that means that the compliance is really important, and like I said, the levy system helps with that. The multinational links have become very critical because of access to germplasm and particularly technology. Australia's germplasm base is very strong for spring wheats in particular, but the technology access for marker systems in particular have been very important. There's 30 to 40 markers for major disease traits and quality traits that are used regularly in wheat breeding in Australia, and they're starting to use genomic approaches. So one of the comments that came from AGT was that compared to the pre-privatisation, they'd reduced the germplasm cycle time by 4 years and increased the effective population size. They were the two sort of key things that they saw happen as they took bigger control of that. But the public sector breeding is still extensive, it's still happening. The current investments, I haven't got the latest estimate on that, but I know that GRDC collects levies of sort of 150 to 200 million per year, but that's across all of the grain crops. And the breeding investment in wheat itself is around about the same as the current investment of the companies themselves. That GRDC's levy is not always 1%. It changes with crop and time, and it's partially matched by the Australian government. So the question for the companies is really how to make sure they deliver this grower value, what processes they can put in to make sure that the growers get the value of this research, and how they can capture the competitive advantage. This is a heavy diagram on the left. You can look it up on the web, but I tried to summarise it on the right-hand side. So there's still a lot of pre-breeding research funded, and most of that GRDC is associated with, but I'll explain there are some other partners who do that as well. That material on genes, traits and parental germplasm still feeds into private wheat breeding, who do the variety development and testing. The national variety trials were established by GRDC as a way of providing an unbiased assessment of all of the new materials to be released, and that was something that farmers wanted, and that was delivered. And then the growers are responsible for collecting the endpoint royalties and research levies back into both of those areas. So just a sort of a current snapshot of where we are in pre-breeding research. These are the agencies that do most of the investment, GRDC, the Australian Research Council, ACR, which is, I think a few people in this room would know, DAF, which is not providing as much as it was. It was the federal government agency which was investing in some of the climate change research and so on. And then there are various public-private partnerships. The main research providers are listed there, departments, universities, CSIRO, ACPFG, and CIMMYT and ACARTA are are research providers, although they don't receive as much research funds as they used to from GRDC. And some examples of these partnerships are CSIRO's alliance with Bayer, ACPFG with DuPont Pioneer, and this new wheat research hub that was just announced a couple of months ago. And actually, I can't tell you much about it because all I saw was a press release. But it part of its job, I think, is to sponsor the development of the new, well, the support of staffing and capability into breeding in Australia. So some examples of activities and infrastructure that are ongoing. There's the CAGE project, which works with Simmet and Akata, sponsored by GRDC. And that's Richard Trethowen's work at the University of Sydney, and it involves visits from Australian breeders to Simmet and Akata in alternate years and an introduction of germplasm. There are plenty of examples of development of parental lines with novel genes and traits. The disease and pest resistance work is a major initiative at the University of Adelaide, particularly for delivering markers to the breeding companies. There's a genomics and SNP facility in DPI Victoria, which provides a fairly low cost access to that for research purposes. In various adaptation areas, there's many projects and providers, and I guess the other major support area is in development of parental lines is in statistical support, which is provided through a national project called the SAGI project. With regard to phenotyping technologies, there's been a national rust screening activity based at the University of Sydney that's been there for I don't know how many years. A very long time. And more recently, a national facility for plant phenotyping, which was providing resources to people undertaking research in wheat and in other crops, and that's was proposed by CSIRO and ANU and the University of Adelaide. And I talked about some of those technologies yesterday. And I guess the last thing was managed environment facilities that were established by GRDC in three major locations for drought and heat research in general. And those are to look at trait value and evaluate prospective lines, as well as to test and deliver this high throughput phenotyping. So they're used in development parental material, but they're also used as a development, sort of a technology development and delivery mechanism. So the breeders visit those sites to see, well, what's the latest technology that's being developed in GRDC research in particular. So I thought I'd just mention a couple of slides. I can skip through these a bit. But some work that we'd done recently was looking at an example of adaptation to climate change in Australia. We've been looking at patterns of frost and heat stress. So here's the date of the last frost day and the date of the first heat day. You haven't got much time to try to fit your flowering time in Australia in this safety zone, particularly down this area in the eastern part and in parts of Western Australia. And so we've done some work, and I'd direct you to the paper on that, but we had looked at climate change scenarios. We were able to predict flowering time quite well with a simulation model to do that. And these are just showing us for different key locations across the country how much the flowering time is going to shift in future climate scenarios, and therefore what's the change in the risk of where the frost stops hitting you and the heat starts hitting you. So you've got to land in this window to try not to get hit by frost or heat. And of course, as you change sowing time, you have to change variety to do that. We've also looked at drought patterns in Australia. Again, I point you towards the publications. But we've looked at different types of drought and the occurrence. The size of these pie charts are associated with the types of drought, whether they're mid-season droughts or end-of-season droughts. That gives us some idea of where these types of drought are more important, and when we're doing managed environment trialing, how we should target that. So there's some systems to help us do that and manage the irrigation to achieve these different types of stresses. And for the same thing, we've also looked at those in the future, and in particular I just draw your attention to the fact that this long terminal kind of drought, which is quite nasty, increases in probability in the 2030, 2050 scenarios. So we're probably going to have to deal with more of those types of stresses as we accelerate the development. So there's certainly a strong history of public research. The new model, the EPR model, has been strongly supported. It's increased the investment in wheat breeding, and it's competitive for breeding and research. But there's still public-private partnerships continued. It's not like they stopped. And I guess the major challenges that remain are in making sure that the research outputs get delivered. Management of those relationships can be tricky at times because GRDC wants to deliver to everyone, and partners don't always want to share the ideas or the technology, so there's a bit of balance that goes on with that. They can always invest themselves. There's been quite a bit of effort, particularly at CSIRO, in demonstration of trait value, so actually building up contrasting traits in lines to show that things are worth investing in. And we need to, I guess, continue, as everyone else does, in to utilise genomic and phenomic technologies and try to work out whether it's worth spending all the money on some of these technologies, and if so, how do we make best use of that. And I think I'd like to leave it there, and again, I'd just like to really acknowledge Steve and Lindsay's input in particular. I'm not a wheat breeder, I'm a physiologist, and I just appreciate the opportunity to give you a view on this from Australia. Thank you.
Thanks.